Frequently enough to make us wonder, there is a violent clash between the government and a group of religious or political radicals, or somewhere a mass suicide. We can count such events in each of the years of the past several, and certainly many before. On this edition of Conversations, we'll ask a scholar who has concentrated on fundamentalist and radical right influences to take a look at that world for us and help us understand. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. And on this edition, our guest is professor and scholar Jeffrey Kaplan. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I hope in the course of our time together that we can make some steps towards differentiating and understanding people whose heart lies at the fringe of the culture on one side or the other. In your writings, I've gathered that a good many of the people on the radical edges are millennialists, people who believe in a second coming and a world post-history governed by a beneficent God. It seems to me that many non-radical fundamentalist believers also believe in a millennium. Is this a spectrum, a continuum, or are there dividing points that...
Well, there's a great deal of overlap, and scholars who look at the subject are often as confused as lay people who look, but they're seeing the real differentiation seems to be on the behavioral plane as opposed to the theoretical. Both groups do have a very strong belief that the world is about to end. The end is imminent. The end will be total. It will be cataclysmic. And yet, out of that cataclysm, there will be a world that will be remade, a perfect world, sinless, a return really to the Edenic era. But the great difference seems to be that among fundamentalists, among the conservative Protestant churches, for example, there isn't a great push to take action. There's a great Bible-based belief that the end will come in God's own time, and only He can know the minute and the hour. Millennialists believe that by one way or another, they can see the signs. They can discern when the end will come and that some action is required. That seems to be the great breaking point.
That a human has a hand in this.
There is a role for, on both sides, there's a role for the faithful in the end times. But the millennialist believes that some action should be taken either to precipitate that end, or if he believes the end has already begun, to in some way play a leading role.
The most familiar, in terms of recent time, might be the Branch Davidian clash at Waco that ended up with so many people dead in such
yes.
a fire. Is this group of that collection of groups, as you
absolutely.
See?
Absolutely, uh-huh. absolutely. A group that began adrift, really, from the conservative Protestantism, fundamentalism, if you will, beyond the reaches of the fundamentalist churches, if you're almost on a continuum, finding that the millennium was indeed very near, that it was necessary in some way to withdraw from the dominant society, withdraw physically as well as culturally and spiritually, and to try to create the life that they envisioned here on earth in preparation for the end times.
I'll ask this differently. Have you described that condition as what you call quietism? Is that withdrawing from?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
The quietism as opposed to active withdrawal. Quietism simply people who want to withdraw as much as possible. It may be extreme withdrawal, actually leaving their homes and going to some isolated region to live either alone as a survivalist perhaps, or to live in communes mm-hmm. or in communities. Mm-hmm. More common than that, however, are people who essentially stay in their own areas, band together, withdraw as much as they can from the society, yet they still have to make a living, they still have to feed their families. But the withdrawals in these cases are spiritual, and yet it's nonetheless absolute.
For such people who, say, don't withdraw as far as Waco, Texas, by any other name, do you sense in your interviews and discussions that it's difficult to live in the place and time from which they're spiritually withdrawn?
Absolutely.
To live in the middle of Fairbanks or San Francisco?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. It's a problem of being unable to control the environment in a way, unable to escape a world they see as downtrodden, as fallen in some way, as with sin having reached its apogee, an impossibility to live a clean and godly life in this view. And that's when the withdrawal will take place, whether it's physical or spiritual. But the idea is to cut as many connections with a society they see as essentially under the rule of Satan as possible.
Jeffrey Kaplan is our guest on this edition of Conversations. His most recent academic work has been with the University of Chicago Fundamentalism Project. That project has put out a series of very thick, thoughtful books by a collection of works by scholars on fundamentalism around the world. And Professor Kaplan was one of the people who edited and worked with that collection. He took his PhD from the University of Chicago, his dissertation in revolutionary millennialism. I can't do this, Jeffrey. This is difficult.
Revolutionary millennialism in the modern world?
In the modern world, from Christian identity to Gush Emunin. Did I say that right?
Emunim.
Thank you. This is going to be this is going to be an exercise in pronunciation. I'll say some of that again at another time so people will get it more clearly. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations on KUAC. Help us to identify both this religious extreme and a political extreme, because I sense also from your writings that people who characterize themselves as neo-Nazis or as the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, or even identity Christians, see themselves as political more than spiritual. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And yet, do they come from the same foundation of beliefs?
Yeah, in my work with them, both in terms of interviews and reading their literature and the kind of books and pamphlets and that sort of thing they put out, they really form a community in a way. Although the particular belief structures may appear different, at heart they absolutely they are spiritual movements, in effect. The idea that the world has completely ignored them, ignored their beliefs, trampled on their view of what community should be, and are withdrawing no less than any other millenarian religious group in some way. And their dreams, although put in different contexts, in different languages, are essentially the same. They're essentially kiliastic, or the idea that a kingdom, a sinless kingdom of the elect, is just about to be formed. And whether they believe, as identity Christians do, that it will be under the benevolent reign of Jesus when he returns, or whether it will be of man's own creation, as some of the neo-Nazi groups believe. Essentially, when they describe this perfect world, it is precisely the same, and it's drawn very heavily from Christian apocalyptic tradition.
And do these people see themselves as chosen above others in particular?
Yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. And the sign of their chosenness is that they understand, from in their context, the truth, that others are blind and deaf. They have done everything they can to publicize their message and find it rejected by the American public. They find themselves removed really from legitimate discourse in this culture. And they take that as a badge of honor, a sign once again that only the righteous remnant, to use a Christian terminology, will be saved. And by their acceptance of the message, they have identified themselves as part of that remnant.
I noticed that phrase throughout your writing. What does remnant mean in this case? Does it mean leftover, as we do for the fabric?
Precisely. Uh-huh. Precisely. But where the great majority will be damned, will be destroyed in the last days, they will be the remnant. They will be the survivors. All who right. will form the heart of this new perfect society. Mm-hmm.
Another differentiation, a great many fundamentalist believers who see themselves as chosen mm-hmm. are also very comfortable with Judaism, and yet members of the extreme would see themselves as very comfortably anti-Semite,
yes.
very comfortably anti-Jewish. How does this division occur?
Well, essentially, again, a long story of the change in Protestant Christianity from essentially an anti-Semitic to a philo or very pro-Semitic belief system based on the prophetic role of the Jews in the last days. So in the last 70, 80 years in the United States, the view in Protestant Christianity of the Jews has become almost exalted. The many people on the radical right fringes, Christian identity believers in particular, began life in the Protestant fundamentalist churches. And they broke with them over the role of the Jews, essentially. They see the Jews as the literal children of the devil and feel that Protestant Christianity has been led astray. And it's part of their crusade is to fight this.
So this, in this case, they feel that Protestant Christianity has fallen away from them, what is truly a true belief.
They feel that it's fallen away from true Bible belief. Not simply them, it's their interpretation of the scripture.
Uh-huh. You have developed a typology, if that's a fair word, of far right groups, and I wonder, you have grazed some of it as we've talked, but I wonder if discussing some of the elements of that typology would help us get a better understanding. One of the first characteristics seems to be that there is a belief that there was a golden time
yes.
in the past. The Klan would see it, I assume, mm-hmm. pre-Lincoln, pre-Civil War.
Oh yeah, essentially for most Klan believers, remember there are a lot of different Klan groups right now, all with very much opposed to each other, all with slightly different visions. But generally, Klan groups you'll see concentrating on the colonial era in one form or another, in which they believe there was a time of perfect peace here in America before minorities had come, before Jews had come. It's ahistorical. It's a golden age fantasy. Never really existed, but it's something very important to them. And they hold it as almost in as high of esteem as the Bible itself.
Is that golden age, since that there was a golden age, a comfortable companion with the apocalypse? Will, when the millennium come, it resemble the past?
Yes, exactly.
It'll
be a restoration of the golden age, and whatever golden age this particular group happens to hold, that's what they want to go back to.
What are some of the other golden age groups? I assume for neo-Nazis it would be the period of National Socialism in Germany?
To some degree. Yeah, that's one of the great divisions in neo-Nazi circles. Again, they're even more divided than the Klan, and far fewer. So a few of them, people you would almost call Hitler cultists, do see that as a perfect time. Others look back into the Christian era. Others go back even to the Edenic era. It depends on the particular group. It's hard for in neo-Nazi circles to make a generalization because they are so very few. And they are so idiosyncratic, really.
It's an interesting thing. You describe them as few. I understand the Ku Klux Klan has the fewest number of members it's ever had. Mm-hmm. And yet let me point to two things, and you can follow either one, I suppose. One seems to be that the groups like the neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan have an image that's larger than they are. The other seems to be that I mentioned as we opened the show that there seem to be violent clashes that we hear about at least yearly in our time, not necessarily just the Klan or neo-Nazis, but violent clashes between the radical right and the culture, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Is it that the image is so strong, or is it that there's a rise in violence even as there is a lessening of absolute numbers?
I think it's a little of both. To a great degree, it's imagery. As if you remember during the Iranian Revolution, the word fundamentalist was thrown around, and within a few years, any kind of religious movement that had political overtones was being called fundamentalist, wherever it occurred in the world and whatever its particular goals were. I think you find that a lot now with the radical right. They are really very few in number in this country. They're more significant in Western Europe right now, and in Eastern Europe it's a growing phenomenon. But no matter what the particular belief system, no matter what the particular group, in press reports of them, they're called neo-Nazi. And it makes it sound like there's a giant underground mm-hmm. of neo-Nazis waiting to restore the Third Reich on a worldwide basis, and it just doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. It's much more complex than that.
Do these groups have any sense of coming together to form a revolution?
That's interesting. Historically, no. Right now, we're looking into connections that are being made remarkably on a transatlantic basis between radical right movements in Europe and radical right movements here. And that's a revolutionary development. It's really very interesting because historically, the radical right were nationalists, ultra-nationalists. Right now, there is, as the Cold War broke down, we're seeing on these fringes the idea of nationalism being broken down and being reformulated. So the basis that these connections, and they are actually quite advanced. It's remarkable how much so. These connections are being formed on a basis of a new kind of nationalism based on race and culture, as opposed to national boundaries.
And so it doesn't matter where you are, it matters what you believe.
What you believe, and what seems to facilitate this is English as a lingua franca. So that activists, I'm looking very closely right now at Sweden, for example. Activists there all speak English remarkably well. And so they're having a greater degree of interconnections, of alliance building procedures with America than they do with neighboring Germany, simply because of language barriers.
An odd question. In a time of 40 Stinger missiles lost by the United States when they pulled out of the Persian Gulf and components of nuclear weapons floating around in underground sails, do nations or communities have reason to be concerned about transatlantic groups like this?
Of course.
Simple answer, of course.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Simply because, not simply the right wing, but terrorist movements of the left and right are becoming far more technological than they ever were before. And the breakdown of the East Bloc has created a black market that wasn't there before. Mm-hmm. So I have been asked, for example, in Christian Identity as a movement, whether they form a threat of nuclear terrorism here. The answer, undoubtedly not. They're not that sophisticated. They are much less involved in this transatlantic interchange than other belief systems on the radical right. But looking at it on a world basis, yes, there is a danger of that. And many of the people involved in the radical right are really quite sophisticated.
You said in the class I sat in on recently that these groups, fundamentalist groups, are inherently unstable. How would stability be arrived at that would create a larger potential for damage?
In what way? I don't quite understand the question.
If fundamentalist political or religious groups are unstable, mm-hmm. What would create the stability to create an ongoing danger? That's what I mean.
Oh, I see. To clarify that, as a movement, I was referring to its instability in terms of people drifting in and out of the community. There's always a core group within fundamentalism who, again, I want to stress that fundamentalists present no threat of terrorism, violence, or anything like it. But to go to the radical right, you see very much the same phenomenon. People drifting in and out of the radical right community, if you will, mm-hmm. to the extent that they can. Once they become too heavily identified publicly with the radical right wing, I have met those in that community who would really like to get out and live a normal life. It's a very stressful, difficult existence. You're rejected by the community. You find that even your own family doesn't understand what you're talking about. It's a lot of family breakup, a lot of problems that go with it. But once you're too heavily identified, it's very hard sometimes to get out. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to start a new life, and that's been found again and again. Still, to go back to your question, within that community there is a hardcore that are absolutely dedicated to the cause And it's among that core group of activists that this danger, if it comes to pass, does exist.
Our guest on this edition of Conversations is Jeffrey Kaplan. To take some steps to reintroduce him, his PhD is from the University of Chicago. The dissertation, Revolutionary Millenarianism in the Modern World, From Christian Identity to Gush
Emunim,
thank you. He has two master's degrees, one in international relations from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, another in linguistics from Colorado State University. He also earned his bachelor's from Colorado State University in history and in Oriental studies. Currently, Jeffrey Kaplan is an assistant professor of social sciences as well as the director of academic and transfer programs at Suvunmun Ilizagvik College. Boy, this is a hard one, Jeffrey. And that, of course, is in Barrow. We're talking with Jeffrey Kaplan about the radical right on this edition of Conversations. Let me see if I can pull two things together, and you can tell me if they're pullable. Another scholar wrote that, also about issues of stability, that cults are inherently unstable, but the cult milieu, the environment that creates the possibility of the cult, is ongoing. Mm-hmm. Is that true for what we think of as rightist, radical, terrorist groups as well?
Absolutely.
And how so? What makes the cult milieu stable?
Now, the very fact that there will always be people who place themselves or are placed outside of the assumptions shared by a particular culture. Always those who are attracted by radical ideas, be they religious or political or whatever. So that as people drift in and out of this community, new groups are being born, even as old ones collapse. And that's also part of the instability. Group formation is based on usually a single leader who, while he has the energy and charisma, will keep a group together. And in the American context, it's even more difficult than that, because where people are so spread out geographically, it becomes almost a mail order ministry, if you will. But at some point, most of those leaders become burned out. It's very difficult to make a career of that. It's certainly not profitable. And at some point, they just get tired of the organizational problems, of the conflict, and drift away. But the people who were reached by that particular group or set of ideas go and search for similar ideas. Failing to find them, they'll form groups of their own. Mm-hmm. And so the community stays in existence. The relative numbers seem to stay fairly stable in as much as we can tell these things. But one group will end and another begin, and there are new people will come to replace those who leave.
Those kinds of pressures and shifts are internal. Are there also external pressures and shifts? If we think about, what's his first name, Randy Weaver?
Randy Weaver.
In Idaho?
In Idaho, yes.
It was an 18-month siege around that man's cabin and mm-hmm. family. In that case, the government pushed at this individual and pushed at his organization with the Branch Davidian. There was also a situation where the FBI was kind of intimately involved in the mm-hmm. affairs of the Branch Davidian movement. The FBI infiltrated the Klan. So this makes mm-hmm. me wonder, does the culture, whether it's government or another aspect, also create the milieu for the cult,
yes.
create the milieu for the rightist group?
Oh, yes. Even with the large degree of personal freedom you have in America as opposed to other countries, the very fact of withdrawal, and particularly a group withdrawal from that society, arouses interest. And that interest is often on an official level. And it'll usually begin with concern for the children, for example, concern for their education, concern for building permits and local codes and zoning and all the kind of everyday things that we take for granted, they will see as yet another evidence of persecution. Once that dynamic begins of a feeling of persecution soon matched by the appearance of real representatives of the government or of private agencies dedicated to protecting the rest of society or informing the rest of society about the doings on the radical fringes. A dynamic can often take place where conflict is virtually inevitable.
You wrote in a particular piece, and I'll look up the title of it in a minute, about the way anti-cult groups and cults or anti
watchdog movements, essentially,
right, tend to become kind of connected to each other mm-hmm. in their zeal, so they see each other as enemies.
Almost symbiotic. They see each other as enemies when the connection begins. But as the years go by, they seem to need each other more and more. The, if you will, the anti-cult group or the watchdog group needs that radical movement as the raison d'etre for its own existence. The radical movement needs the watchdog because it needs an audience. Otherwise, it feels isolated and alone, and the very fact that if it's one of the anti-Semitic groups, the Anti-Defamation League, for example, if it's a true cult movement, say the Cult Awareness Network, the very fact that they're interested in them is demonstration of their importance, and they can use that in their recruiting and in their internal internal cheerleading, if you will.
Is there almost a non-existent but felt persecution that rolls back and forth between the two? You mentioned that the groups on the fringes feel themselves to be persecuted. Mm-hmm. Is some of this persecution not real but felt?
Some of it is not real but felt. Some of it is actually quite real.
Uh-huh.
They have been singled out to a large degree. And if the group ethos was nonviolent to begin with, given isolation, particularly physical isolation, when they've actually withdrawn physically from the society, and the first perception of persecution, and then the reality of it on occasion, will often create the arena for violence. And that's when the violent confrontations begin.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Kaplan, our guest on this edition of Conversations. We're looking as much as we can at the radical right, the extremes of society, and when they burst into flame. You'll be interested that Jeffrey Kaplan has a book coming out called Revolutionary Religion in America. It's contracted to the University of California Press, and I understand the last editing is being done now. So coming out
relatively
when?
Soon.
Relatively soon.
Impossible to tell at this point.
In the phrases of authors, relatively soon. There are articles to be found in the Journal of Terrorism and Political Violence is one. Another is the Journal of Alternate Religion and Culture, but its name
is Syzygy.
Thank you. Articles on the context of American millenarian revolutionary theology, on the literature of the rescue movement, Operation Rescue in America, on the anti-cult movement in America, and a good deal more. An article under review, Multigenerational Satanism, the Eternal Conspiracy, which should appear in American Studies Journal. On this edition of Conversations, we're taking a look at the extremes with Professor Jeffrey Kaplan. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. You talked a little bit about when movements erupt into violence. When does a group become a terrorist organization? Are there splits that scholars can see that create that possibility?
Very difficult question. We're looking at it very closely now because there is a lot of concern, particularly on the European side, that is about to occur. Essentially, a movement, particularly on the radical right, can become more and more radicalized. At the point when they become a true terrorist movement is very difficult to find. A true terrorist movement will routinize their violence. It will plan it. It will become the idea of a plan, if you will, and a course of action with long-term objectives and short-term strategies. This is considerably different than the kind of violence you saw, say, with the Branch Davidians, mm-hmm. where the explosion is sudden, it's unplanned, it's the result of circumstances that in retrospect may well have been avoided. It certainly wasn't done for any long-range goal or anything that would have changed the surrounding society. It was simply an unfortunate situation that happened. Terrorism is something else. It's planned, it's logical, and it has objectives which, while it may not seem to be rational to you or I, mm-hmm. to the members of that group, it is absolutely rational, and it's a way of life.
Are there cultures that seem to support the terrorists in their environment, however inadvertently, better than others? It's, we don't have much of what we think of as terrorism in this country, but if we go to Italy, or if we go to Ireland or Iran, we see that terrorism is much more common, accepted and feared by the people.
I think less cultures than political systems
okay.
that engender terrorism or violence. When there is no hope of peaceful change, when there's no hope of evolutionary change, terrorism becomes a possibility. When persecution becomes real and begins to touch people, touch families, as opposed to something that's out there on the fringes, terrorism becomes much more a possibility and a reality.
So part of the Irish community feels trapped in its own country mm-hmm. and has to break out inside.
Mm-hmm. And terrorism is lessened and eventually dissolves when a political avenue or a political space is opened up in which negotiations and compromise can take place between mainstream communities. Mm-hmm. And then without a milieu to exist in, terrorism will fade.
But tell me if this is asking for more than you think you can talk about in this space of time, but we've seen recent relative peace in Ireland and recent relative peace between Israel and Palestinians, and yet there seems to be far more recent violence in the one than in the other. Where's the door locked off in the Israeli-Palestinian situation that doesn't seem to be locked off in Ireland?
I can speak much less for Ireland than for the Palestinian situation. But essentially in Palestine, there are a lot of dynamics that are coming to a head in this peace process. The religious trend as opposed to Arafat's nationalist trend, for example. The involvement of surrounding states in the peace process, particularly Jordan, will be key, simply because Jordan's claim on the Holy Land and the Palestinians' claim on the Holy Land are in conflict. Within Hamas, or the religious opposition, if you will, the religious violent opposition in any case, there is the absolute belief based on their interpretation of the Quran and on their interpretation of Arab history that any compromise made with the Israeli state is illegitimate and must be opposed, which sets up a dynamic of internal conflict within the Palestinian community, mm-hmm. which will drag everybody else in.
So among other things, there are more than just two voices.
Oh, yes.
And each voice has a different view that
yes.
is not willing to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
This refusal to compromise is going to be another aspect of this kind of mental set, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, when what you're fighting for is absolute good, a perfect society, a new world, the idea of compromise becomes impossible. Where you're fighting for an improvement or an evolutionary process, a political solution to a problem, then compromise is inevitable. And between the two ways of looking at the world, there is very little connection and very little dialogue possible.
Mm-hmm. You have talked about American extreme movements as believing in conspiracy theories. Not only do they feel alienated and pushed aside, but everything from, what did you say earlier, building permits to taxes are seen as the sign of a controlling hand.
Yes.
Is that also a global aspect?
Yes, it is. A very old way of looking at the world. Essentially, it's a Manichaean belief system. The idea that the earth is a battleground between two forces, absolute good, represented obviously by God, absolute evil by the devil. The earth is very much the devil's domain. And between the two, there is a constant war, which will end at the end of time. Every human being must take a side. at that point, the idea of accident, of history happening because of accidental causation, of events happening because of a process rather than a controlling force, for those who have this very strong Manichaean or dualist belief system, it becomes almost a conceptual impossibility. Satan is behind every action. Behind, or in front of Satan, as a mask of Satan, are his servants on earth. And on the far right, those are defined as Jews, as the United States government. And recently there has been, in radical right circles, very little differentiation made between the two. Thus the term Zionist occupation government for the, or ZOG for the United States government, has become the common coin of the realm.
I say this only so you will explain further. This is not a theoretical Satan.
Nope. No, absolutely not. This is Satan as an entity, as a being, the biblical Satan. And he is real and he is active.
This must, people who believe in this must feel incredibly alienated in America, where there is such a willingness to excuse flaws. Human beings are not evil, they're flawed. I ask you, that seems to me to be an American, profound American notion.
Oh yes, and yes. Particularly in recent years. The medicalization of virtually any kind of what would have been called in a previous time, sin. For the millenarians who are on this radical right fringe, or for fundamentalists, for that matter, who are much closer to the heart of the culture. Mm-hmm. In either case, this is seen as impermissible. It's yet another mask of Satan. The idea that there is no absolute good or no absolute evil is completely alien to this way of looking at the world.
How does a radical rightist hope to stand up against such a conspiracy?
It's a remarkable way of looking at the world. The idea that because this conspiracy is so great and because so many are involved and the powers arrayed against you are so unbelievable, are so unchallengeable, if that's a word, the idea of winning is, for us, if we looked at it on a rational basis, impossible. For the millenarian, though, that means the worse the situation is, the better it is. The very fact that you're arrayed against such an unbelievable force indicates that the world has now reached the state of absolute sin, where it just can't get any worse. Thus, it's the best of times. Thus, if it's a Christian millennial belief system, Jesus will come, or the world will end. And that tiny, persecuted, righteous remnant, those who held fast against the entire world, will in fact be those who inherit the earth, for they are truly the meek.
Why would God want to come back to such a world?
To put it right. To have allowed Satan his time on earth, and to complete the covenant, complete his promise, that at the end of time, he will return and he will punish the wicked and reward the good.
I understand that there's a time of what's called capital T tribulation. Mm-hmm. Is that the period of punishing the wicked? And what does that look like to a millenarianist?
Well, it depends on the particular millenarian belief system, but in general, it's a period where, for a short time, and traditionally that's 3.5 of a 7-year tribulation cycle, there will be the creation of such entities as a world government. An Antichrist figure will appear, and he will peacefully, at first, beguile or trick the population of the world into following him with his promises of creating a better or perfect world. There will be those who, as the millenarians see themselves, don't believe in that, who will reject this false teaching and hold fast despite their persecution, at which time there will be a global war of some kind, and the cataclysms will engulf the earth, and out of that final 3.5-year tribulation will emerge a new world in which the good will be rewarded and the evil will be forever punished.
This may sound like a naive question, but we live in a period of famines and war and natural disaster upon natural disaster. Are there people who believe we're in that period now?
Oh, yes. And it has always been so. As we go back through history, we find there have always been groups who have looked around them, seen these very things that you have pointed out, and said that's the evidence that the world is about to end, and we're going to have to do something about it. And whatever that is, they have taken action. The world has never ended. Now the signs are becoming more complex. After the nuclear age, there was for a time a switch to nuclear cataclysm, sure, which on the radical right now is still somewhat in vogue, but now in some of what you could almost call the New Age or cult movements, not to confuse the two, who are looking at the world in millenarian terms, the emphasis is more and more on man-made ecological disasters. But whatever causes the cataclysm, the results are the same. The world will end.
You differentiated a new cult movement. What?
Kind of New Age as opposed to true cults. What the difference would be a show in itself. But essentially, New Age movements would be new spiritual movements, which are eclectic, which combine Eastern and Western traditions, magical traditions, et cetera, et cetera, which go back to the observation earlier, the psychologizing of religious beliefs, self-help, mm-hmm, in a religious context is really, I think, what the New Age is all about, as opposed to cult movements where a particular leader will invest himself with charisma, gather followers, usually based on a standing tradition, Christianity or an Eastern tradition, mm-hmm, and as time goes on, drift farther and farther from the tradition where they began, as the Branch Davidians did from Christianity.
Yeah. You, in one or two of your articles, you discussed Odinism. Mm-hmm. How does a neo-pagan, a wicked,
Wicked. The fundamentalists would say wicked.
They would.
And they do.
How does a neo-pagan, a Wiccan tradition fit into this, the other set of radical right beliefs?
Very uncomfortably, which is why the Odinists find themselves in a ambiguous position. The Odinists, just to define, are a group who are trying to revive the ancient Norse tradition. Odin, Thor, Freya, etc. They have divided within themselves into two communities, one called the Asa True community, who are non-racist, they simply fit more closely into the Wiccan neo-pagan tradition, which is very accepting, a very gentle kind of belief system, if you will, as opposed to the Odinists, who took that same core set of beliefs, the attempt to revitalize the northern tradition, the ancient northern pre-Christian tradition, grafted in some National Socialist beliefs, and have created a racialist movement, which kind of fits very uncomfortably between this Wiccan neo-pagan occult world and the world of the radical right.
Do those who embrace Odinism from a neo-Nazi point of view see it as Aryan because it's Norse?
Yes.
Is it that simple?
That's part of it. The other part is the idea that the Christian tradition is based on Jewish antecedents, which all would agree. Mm-hmm. And if it was based on Jewish antecedents, therefore it's alien to the European Aryan tradition, and it was in fact a plot to subvert the northern peoples into essentially a conspiracy.
Hmm. Can I ask you a question about,
sure,
kind of your bent as a scholar? Do you see, when you look around the world, do you see the world rich with religious traditions and religious spiritual potential, or like ecologists, do you see that we're losing species of, if I can kind of blend these two sciences rather poorly, but that's kind of the way it appears in my mind. Do you see that we've got, I mean, I was just thinking about Odinism as a possible religious perspective and wondering whether we're getting richer in this world with our range of spiritual beliefs, or poorer?
I think really far richer. And as a trend, I think it's really very healthy. And as with any trend, you have groups that will branch off, as with the radical right, and make that trend appear dangerous and threatening to the dominant society. In fact, I think it's a strength. And the pathology of the radical right shouldn't detract from the richness and depth that the current religious experimentation is providing.
And what of futures? There are a number of religions who, as fundamentalist Christians do, believe that theirs is the only religion, that only their people will be blessed, whether in the afterlife or in this life. Do you see that there is a darker potential, that we will not accept each other, not live comfortably on the planet with a wide range of beliefs, or are we going to kind of make it through and always stay fairly divergent in our beliefs as a species?
Well, that darker potential is always there and always has been. But I think as the world gets smaller, as the communications become more widespread, as really computer communications become increasingly widespread, which is on the one hand one of the primary ways that the radical right is communicating with each other on this transatlantic convergence. But it's also opening up discussion, opening up doors of information which didn't exist before. And where that dark potential exists, it exists largely in ignorance. As the world becomes smaller, as the communications revolution opens up these communities, makes them appear less exotic, less threatening, I think that the future is really much brighter.
I guess this is just a survey of curiosities for me in this phase of our discussion. We have seen in the past 10 or so years a rise in mainstream political life and mainstream religious life of a more right-leaning religious view, whether it is in Fairbanks or whether it is in the Nation, of a Christian politic. That's the way to look at it. Yeah. This is not new in this nation. Is this something, as a fundamentalist scholar, you see goes in movements and waves
in
through
cycles,
our time?
Really. Uh-huh. In cycles. It's the 60s were a great shock to the fundamentalist community. They had largely withdrawn from the culture in the wake of the Scopes trial, for example. Immediately after Scopes, there were a lot of battles within the denominations for control of really the soul of the denomination. And the fundamentalists lost virtually every one of those battles. They withdrew, and the 60s came as a great shock. It brought them back into the culture, back into the political system, building up through the Moral Majority, through the Nixon and Reagan administrations. And at this point, they are now very much part of the culture. And really, the dialogue engendered there, I think, is quite healthy. The idea that they're about to take over in some nefarious way, I think, is an idea that's popular in the culture, certainly popular in the media. Mm-hmm. It's simply not going to happen. Fundamentalism and power are almost, in the American context, mutually exclusive.
Because
to take power in this society requires compromise, requires alliances. Mm. Once those alliances begin to be made by fundamentalist leaders, and Jerry Falwell is a perfect example of this, once you begin making those alliance relationships necessary to build a coalition to take power, you find that your base, your core supporters, are unable to accept those compromises with the society they see as fallen. And you lose your base. Thus, the Moral Majority dissolved.
So the greatest power from a fundamentalist point of view is in their power to influence.
Their power to influence, and to use a Christian terminology, the idea to warn, to teach. to proselytize and evangelize and attempt to, through their dialogue, through their perspective, to bring the culture back to a more conservative, a more traditional base as they understand it.
Mm-hmm. This stance as the warner is the one who stands on the watchtower.
Yes.
Looking out and looking in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Jeffrey Kaplan is our speaker today on this edition of Conversations. I'll give you an opportunity to learn a bit more about our guest. Currently, once again, he's a professor at the Savunmun Ilisagvik College, which is in Barrow, Arctic Savunmun Ilisagvik College, has been there since 1993. Prior to that, he was a lecturer at the University of Chicago, the Fundamentalism Project of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences was one of his major focuses. He worked with submissions of senior academics around the world on a multi-volume set of books, which has been published, illustrating the various facets of religious fundamentalism from across the spectrum of religious traditions and geographical regions. You'll find writings by Jeffrey Kaplan in a book coming out in the next couple of years. Look for its title, Revolutionary Religion in America, from the University of California Press. It's in a final drafting stage, so don't look at it quite yet. Look for Jeffrey's works in such periodicals as the Journal of Terrorism and Political Violence, and say it for me again.
Syzygy.
Why won't I just say that? And Syzygy, a journal of alternative religion and culture. What does Syzygy mean?
It's essentially the twins, the positive and negative principles from mythology.
Okay, which is why it looks at alternative religion and culture. Nice, all right. Also, another piece is under review with the American Studies Journal, so look for writings in that journal as well. Jeffrey Kaplan has anthology chapters in From the Ashes, Making Sense of Waco, a book edited by James Lewis, another by Lewis, also editor, The Magical Religions and Modern Witchcraft. Jeffrey Kaplan, our guest on this edition of Conversations. You worked extensively with a fundamentalist scholar, a religion scholar named Martin Marty at University of Chicago. And he has developed what you referred to as religion mapping. My sense of this is it's a way to understand beliefs across the spectrum of potential belief, yes?
Yeah, it's...
How can we use, in the not too many more minutes we have left, such a concept as religious mapping to kind of understand where our spiritual beliefs fall?
Well, it's more of a scholarly convenience than a reality at this point. The purpose of it is to try to point to discover a group of beliefs, trends, and ideas which constitute the mainstream culture. As you go out from that mainstream, what might in religious terms say religious scholars use be called the American public square. As you go further from that, he is trying to identify points of acceptability, where the divisions occur, why people leave this community, and as they leave, how far away do they go, and can they come back? Do they come back? For the kind of work I do, I find it useful simply to show where the various radical communities, millenarian or cult that I look at, where they exist in relation to each other and in relation to the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. So it's more a scholarly convenience than a reality at this point.
Is there a locus of beliefs that the dominant culture membership shares?
There undoubtedly are, but to actually identify them and then present them in a way that each group that constitutes that dominant culture would accept would be very difficult.
Is it sometimes very difficult to be a religious scholar?
Oh, yes. But interesting. Always interesting.
The outside looks very different from the inside?
Mm-hmm. The outside looks different from the inside, and even within the scholarly community, there are as many divisions among us as there are among the groups we look at.
Mm-hmm. Then my question is, what makes such a mapping exercise convenient?
Yeah, it's important in my work, as I say, simply to identify how distant some of the groups that I look at are from the dominant culture, both from the perspective of the culture itself, and more interesting for me, from the perspective of the believers in these various communities. How do they look at our culture? What is their critique? Mm-hmm. And that's why mapping theory is of use to me.
It also gives you points along the line so that you can watch people shift.
Yes.
And move.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. How'd you get involved in this?
Well, after I finished my undergraduate, I began a period of traveling. I became a teacher of English as a foreign language, really, and spent most of my career in the Middle East at a time of great change there. I was in Iran as the Iranian Revolution unfolded, and left there and went to Saudi Arabia in time for the seizure of the Mecca Mosque and the uprising of the Shia in eastern Saudi Arabia. Found the vitality and energy of religion was something I hadn't I wanted to understand more of. And that was the beginning of my study.
And life work, I gather.
Yes.
Yeah. What's next?
Very good question. Continue largely what I'm doing. I'm very happy in Barrow. Mm-hmm. And we're building a college there that I think has great potential. And again, thanks to the wonders of email and mass communications, I'm able to continue my research and my work in my own field. So I see more of the same.
Jeffrey Kaplan, thank you very much. It's been a most interesting hour.
Thank you.
I'll give you give folks just another notion or two so that they can follow along. Dr. Kaplan has edited a book called The Land and People of Old Tikigaq. It's a textbook for North Slope Borough High School students. He is also working as part of his public service as a liaison to the Inupiat History and Culture Project, a well-developed project, and has been doing that in Barrow since he arrived in 1993. Once again, look for the new book, Revolutionary Religion in America, and his writings in journals about religion. I'm Susan McGinnis. It's been a pleasure to talk to Jeffrey Kaplan for this hour of conversations. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you join me again next week.